a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Ag and Natural Resources will come to adjournment. I didn't say come to order. Tuesday morning, we're here. At this time, I'd like to welcome the internet listeners for our bright and blustery South Dakota morning. And also, I'd remind everybody in the audience, just a brief reminder for turn off the cell phones. And at this time, I'll ask the secretary to call the roll.
Senators Ewing, Frerichs,
here.
Lucas,
here.
Amdahl,
here.
Otten,
here.
Roden,
here.
Valley,
here.
Rampelberg,
here.
Krebs,
here. Quorum is present. Boy, I'm really got to get the bugs out this morning. This time, the chair will minutes.
So moved.
Second. Moved by Senator Lucas, seconded by Senator Frerichs. All those in favor of approval minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are so approved. At this time, we have two items on the agenda. We have the overview from Game, Fish, and Parks, and the second item is the Senate Bill 20, which is an act to revise the purpose of the Agricultural Mediation Program. I believe we have our guests of honor today here, the Game, Fish, and Parks, so I will turn it over at this time and making sure that you've all signed in if you are going to be presenting today. So, Mr. Secretary, Secretary Vonk, are you ready? Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Krebs. Thank you for providing me the time to brief you and the committee a little bit on some of the comings and goings of Game Fish and Parks. I'd like to start this morning.
Is your mic on?
Now it is. There we go. Thank you.
Reintroduce yourself for the internet listeners.
My name is Jeff Fonk. I'm your secretary for the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. I'd like to begin this morning with just a real quick rundown on three new projects that Governor Dugard talked about in his budget address, and I'd just like to recap those briefly for the committee. While this will more likely fall in the appropriations realm, I think it's important for the department and hopefully for the committee to hear a little bit about what these projects entail. So we've called these projects the Outdoor Heritage Projects, and they will be included in Governor Dugard's special appropriations request. There are three of them. The first deals with the new state park, which we hope you'll approve through separate action at the site at Blood Run outside of Sioux Falls. The Blood Run site, which we've talked to you about in the past, is a culturally and naturally rich heritage site here in South Dakota. Falls along the Big Sioux River. It is a place where Native Americans historically met and traded for pipestone, which tribes all across the Great Plains found to be valuable, and so they would convene. There was a settlement there. And the folks that lived there basically traded in pipestone for other goods that folks brought to the site. It's also a naturally unique place. It's this picture here depicts the oak forest. It's an oak savanna ecotype, which is somewhat rare and disappearing. And so not only would this site provide protection for the cultural heritage there, but also would afford protection for a remnant of the oak savanna ecotype. This past year, we talked to you about having purchased 300 acres that was the heart of the Blood Run site, and because we were able to get that done, we had a naturalist on site during the summer. And we hosted many different school groups and other visitors on a makeshift trail system that got people out in looking at the site and beginning really to take advantage of having that natural site right close to Sioux Falls. It was probably, I would say, attendance and participation exceeded our expectations, having very little infrastructure in place at this point in time. This is just a map to kind of, again, show you the location of the Blood Run site in its proximity to the city of Sioux Falls. So you can see that as a new state park, one of our, well, our largest population center will have easy access to it. The second project we're excited about is the possibility of constructing a new visitor center at Custer State Park. Tastes and opportunities change with time. This is a picture of the Norbeck Visitor Center that's on site today. Most of you probably know where that is as you enter the park on, I think it's Highway 63, up on a hill after you pass the Game Lodge is this structure, which is our current visitor center. Our vision here would be to create a modern visitor center that would include a movie theater, much on the order of what we see in our national parks today. It would give visitors the opportunity to experience vicariously the many attributes and opportunities for recreation and learning that exist in Custer State Park, give them a pretty complete orientation, we think would build the excitement of being there and help promote the park even more than it currently is. We've done a little bit of work, looking at options for where this might be located. One of those options is depicted here in an artist rendition, and this would be right off the entrance highway. You can see in the background of this slide the roof line of the Game Lodge. So this would be coming in to the park on Highway 63, right before you get to the Game Lodge. The Creekside Lodge, which is a relatively new structure, would be on the other side of the creek behind us. Right now, if you've been there recently, you'll recall there's like a small building where they rent bicycles that would be on this current site. The other option that was looked at would be right across the highway from the existing visitor center. There's a large open grassy meadow where a new visitor center could be tucked into the trees there and provide easy access for folks that were coming into the park. And the final project is a trail connector from Hill City to Mount Rushmore. It's an 18-mile bike trail it'd be a multi-use trail. Actually, it would be available for hikers, bikers, and for horseback riders if it gets constructed. This project's been under study and underway for more years than I've been here. We have two critical federal partners as we've tried to work through the details. Almost the entire length of the trail will be constructed on federal property, which brings with it certain requirements of study, analysis, and public input and comment. The Forest Service and the Park Service have worked closely with us. The other two partners depicted on this slide are private nonprofits. The Mount Rushmore Society and the South Dakota Parks and Wildlife Foundation have all committed private fundraising efforts in an effort to move this project forward. Last fall, we were successfully able to conclude a feasibility study, which actually looked at several different options for where the trail would be laid out. And we had agreement finally, and so we know where it will be. The next step would be to construct or to conduct an environmental impact statement and analysis, and then once that's concluded, would be to raise the money to actually do the construction. So, in total, the governor will be asking in a special appropriation for a total of $4 million of general funds. $2 million for the Blood Run development, $1.5 million for the Custer State Park Visitor Center, and $500,000 that would be used as seed money for private fundraising and for match of anticipated other trail funds that would be brought to bear from the federal appropriation. So the grand total budget for those three projects to get things moving is $10 million. You can see how that breaks down. $4 million in general funds and $4 million in private sector funds generated by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation and the Mount Rushmore Society. Parks and Wildlife Foundation has already passed a resolution, has committed to their part of this. Director Hofer has had a chance to meet with the Rushmore Society, and while they have not yet passed a resolution, we believe are committed to doing such at their next meeting. So we're very confident that that the total of $10 million, if we get the general fund appropriation, will be available to do these projects, and would expect all the construction, other than the final construction of the trail, to be completed in 2 years. I wanted to recap a little bit of the flood damage and what's happened since. This map basically shows you the park sites in South Dakota that received the most damage to the flooding in 2011. You can see most of it was concentrated along the Missouri River, most of it, again, below the different dams. There was also some damage to Fisher Grove State Park from the James River that flooded, and at Lake Thompson, where we had very high waters and had a lot of erosion damage to our campground at that facility. Some real quick slides to show you what things looked like during the flood. This was at Owyhee Downstream Campground, right below the dam here in Pier. In the fall, after the water receded, you can see the erosion damage that occurred, and this was the recovery. Was shaped, graded, put some riprap in, and got some seeding established. At Farm Island, at the trailhead at Farm Island, this was during the flood. When the waters receded, you can see the damage from washouts. Some of the trees were dying. And then post-recovery last summer, we were able to get in there and clean that up and redo the trail. Actually, the trail is in great shape right now. The Farm Island Shop, we have a park manager residence, a garage, and a shop building, all flooded during 2011. See the damage to mold and from the flooding at the facility at the shop. Had to tear out the sheetrock and the walls up to where the mold had developed. And today, that's all been restored, and we're back in business full time. So as a post-flood, last year there was a $2 million appropriation, again during a special request from the governor for flood repair. That was approved by the legislature. So that money plus the money that we reprogrammed for flood recovery from our normal parks budget amounted to about $7.5 million total that we estimate needed to be put in place to recover. We spent about $4 million of that so far. We'll complete the last $3 million before July of this year. And then we have a $500,000 included in our budget proposal for the coming fiscal year. Most of that will be used to relocate the campground at Fisher Grove. The issue at Fisher Grove was the campground was on the wrong side of the river for access, and we had a bridge there that had been damaged and to the point where it was deemed not to be safe for vehicular traffic. And rather than budget a lot more money to replace or rebuild that bridge, it was determined it would be cheaper and in the long run probably a better solution to move the campground to the other side of the river. So that's our plan going into this summer. Just to let you know kind of what happened in 2012 post-flood, we had 270,000 camper units or camper nights. That would be a campsite rented for a night. It was a record year for us. It was up 13% over a down year, which was 2011 due to the flooding. But it was also up 3% over our previous record, which was in 2010. Visitation was close to 8 million visitors, up slightly from our record year of 2010 and up 11% from the flood year. And the big deal for us revenue-wise was that we were up 11% in 2012 over the 2011 flood year. So we recovered nicely. The staff has done, a marvelous job of their efforts to make the repairs, and our visiting public has reacted positively. We're seeing record use of our state parks as we go forward. I will point out to the committee, many of you probably were at the tourism banquet last week, and we're really proud of our staff for their work in receiving the Mickelson Star Service Award. We've been an applicant for that over several years, and this year finally State Park System was recognized for the great service that we do provide our visitors. Often we get questions about visitation to our parks. Is it South Dakotans or is it other folks? If you look at our system as a whole, you'll see that it's about 70% of our visitation, or our camping at least, is from residents versus 30% from non-residents. That breaks a little differently when you look at individual parks. If you look at Custer State Park, 75% of our campers at Custer State Park are non-residents versus 25 resident. Lewis and Clark, we shift more directly to benefit or usage by residents versus non-residents. That breaks down close to a 60-40 break. And then if you look at all the other parks combined, 80% of our campers are South Dakota residents compared to 19% of the non-residents. Just a quick note on an economic impact study. We contracted with the University of South Dakota Business School to take a look at snowmobiling and what impact that may have on our economy. They did, a good job of taking a look at that and identified $130 million in annual economic impact to South Dakota from snowmobiling. $58 million in revenues to the snowmobile retailers and distributors. More than $15 million is spent annually on lodging, restaurants, and other trip-related spending. It supports directly and indirectly over 1,400 full-time jobs in the state. And residents and non-residents alike rate snowmobiling in the Black Hills more highly than alternative destinations that were surveyed. So it's a highly sought after destination for people to come to South Dakota and for our residents to go to the Black Hills to practice their sport. And as you know, that's one of the key budget items for our Parks and Recreation Division. We provide all the trail grooming and a lot of the support for snowmobiling across the state, but specifically in the Black Hills. Real quickly, just a couple of notes on the hunting and fishing side of the department. Based on the five-year survey that the Fish and Wildlife Service does nationally, South Dakota generates about $1.2 billion in economic activity for wildlife-related activities across the state. One interesting fact, at least to me it was, that South Dakota is number one nationally in the percentage of residents who participate in hunting. That exceeds Alaska, Wyoming, and some of the states that you might think actually would be a higher participation rate. And we rank number four in the percentage of residents who fish. Our fishing license sales increased rather dramatically, actually, from 2011, last year. The interesting part of 2011 was we actually had really great fishing in 2011, but because of the Missouri River flood, and I would say the media attention paid to the flooding, even though it was fairly localized, people stayed home. And so last year, the word was out that the fishing was good. People came. Our resident annual licenses increased 17%. Non-resident annual licenses increased by 36%. The resident combination was up 6%. And then we put a new senior combination license on the market, and we sold about 5,000 of those. So 2012 was a good recovery year for fishing license sales and participation, if you will. You've probably heard some concern expressed about the walleye fishery at Lake Oahe. We did document a fairly high loss of smelt, which is the primary forage fish for walleye in Lake Oahe, through the dam due to the flooding. That happened. And then in 2012, we didn't get what we would have hoped would have been a highly successful reproductive smelt spawn. So that didn't happen either. So basically, our prime forage fish for walleye, at least, is at a low level right now. We did move 1,800 adult gizzard shad from Lake Sharp up to Lake Oahe. They did, from studies at least, apparently have a successful spawn, and that sort of helped offset some of the loss of other forage fish. But we're still low with regard to forage. Reduced forage means slow growth for the game species that we have in the lake. We've documented a near record abundance of fish around that 15-inch, slightly smaller size. We went and talked with our commission earlier, and the commission did increase the daily bag limit on Lake Oahe to 8 fish from the normal 4. That 4 extra fish must be of smaller than 15 inches. We're trying to provide the opportunity, but also to our anglers, but also to deal with the smaller fish abundance by letting folks keep more of those fish, and then correspondingly increase the possession limit to 24 as well. Our hunting small game licenses, general hunting license sales held pretty steady. We've been fairly consistent, down slightly on the resident side on the non-resident side, but still in that 95,000 to 100,000 mark, which is a mark that we hit 4 or 5 years ago and have been pretty steady since. Our resident small game and combination sales were down just very slightly, and the non-resident licenses to hunt on shooting preserves was up very slightly. Big game licenses, we sold about 150,000 for all big game species combined. These license availability have declined somewhat in the last 2 years as we've hit the deer management goals for herd reduction in various parts of the state. We still have various parts of the state where we haven't hit those goals, and we'll continue to provide opportunity to sportsmen in those. Well, opportunity be provided everywhere, but there'll be more opportunity where we haven't hit the goal yet. And then the breakdown of deer licenses that were made available is provided to you. You also, I'm sure, read and heard about the breakout that we had of EHD, the deer die-off that from epizootic hemorrhagic disease. It is a disease that tends to, it's present pretty much every year, but in exceedingly dry years, we seem to have a higher incidence rate of that, and that certainly was the case last year. It was especially prevalent in southeast and south-central South Dakota in 2012. We had requests from several landowners to close the season entirely. We chose not to do that because it wasn't prevalent to that drastic a degree across any given unit. There were certainly parts of units where that might have been warranted, but not across an entire unit. Our advice to landowners was if you don't think you have any deer left, then don't let people hunt. I mean, they're in charge of their land. But at the same time, we thought, you know, our hunters are applying for licenses ahead of time. So they've already bought a license. Then this outbreak happens. Then the landowner shuts them down. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't stick people with a license that they couldn't use based on early plans. And so we did allow folks to get a refund for any license that they didn't feel they could use. And so we did refund 2,624 licenses. About $175,000 will be returned to those folks who turned their license in. And we also stopped selling licenses in those areas where we had unsold licenses available. Our online license sales system, I think probably the big number here to pay attention to is that almost 90% of all of our big game applications are now submitted online. Very few folks are still hanging on to the paper. We still do the paper application process, but folks are migrating pretty heavily now to electronic means. Even a third of our general hunting and fishing license buyers buy their licenses at home online, although two-thirds still want to go into that store, and the store owners certainly appreciate that, I'm sure. Wildlife damage management, we work with landowners across the state on both predator control and also trying to help mitigate damage to crops and hay crops through our wildlife damage management program. With the high value currently with commodity crops, we've found more and more complaints over damage due to geese, especially in the eastern part of the state. And deer continue to be a challenge in some areas. Predator control, especially, well, across the state, but it's probably more especially West River, and then beaver and elk also. So we've given you a chart here that outlines our estimated expenses trying to help mitigate damages due to wildlife on crops and in livestock. Our walk-in program, which I would rate as probably one of the best in the nation. We had 1.1 million acres this past year enrolled in the walk-in program. Those are acres, private land, that are available to the public for hunting purposes. We spent $2.2 million on those 1.3 million acres of access. We also have established special access areas in the Northeast related to enhanced opportunities on private ground for Canada goose hunting primarily. We also run a program called the Controlled Hunting Access Program, where landowners are reimbursed based on the number of hunters that they allow. So it's a more of a landowner control thing. It's not wide open. They can kind of set some limits, and then we pay them for the number of folks that they let on their property. We lease 36,000 acres here north of Pier. Again, that's primarily oriented to geese, but other kinds of hunting also occurs there, both deer and pheasant and other small game. And we also have 730 landowners right now signed up in our Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which is located in the James River Basin. So we've got about 75,000 acres currently under contract. And our goal there was 100,000 acres, and I would expect probably more acres to continue to be enrolled here in the next year. We work pretty hard at providing fishing opportunities as well to folks across the state. We work on improved shore fishing access. Built 12 new fishing piers and access points for shore fishing this past year, in addition to 40 sites that are ADA accessible. We maintain over 100 access sites for ice fishing, which includes snow removal primarily, so that folks can have easy access to good fishing out on the ice. In this past year, we collected 130 million fish eggs and stocked 94 million fish and eggs in 265 of our water bodies across the state. Just real quickly, it'll surprise some of you that we have 6,800 fans of Game, Fish, and Parks on Facebook, and that number is just growing by leaps and bounds. We also do kind of how-to YouTube videos. Staff puts those out. We've had 25,000 views on those. We've sent over 3 million last year targeted emails to license holders, and this is basically reminder kinds of things on email, telling folks when a particular season is going to be open for application, or reminding them of a season opening or closing, that kind of thing. We do commission meeting information, press releases, and other information to folks that have hunting and fishing interests and have provided their email address to us. And then we also spend a fair amount of time surveying our users to try and better understand what their needs are and what they're happy about and where we can improve our service. So we did 47 harvest and public opinion surveys last year. Technology is something that we continue to try and invest in. You can see here there's a whole collection on our website of different maps that I think our users find helpful, shore fishing opportunities that identifies where all the boat ramps are, public hunting areas, pheasant harvest data. We have one tool that tracks the fall waterfowl migration patterns so that people know where to go and scout at any given time during the season. They'll know where the abundance of ducks and mostly it's ducks people are tracking, where they happen to be as they move through the state in the fall. All of our public land boundaries are digitized, and we make those available to folks that have Garmin and Lowrance GPS, these handheld GPS units. People are able to download all that data onto their GPS unit, and then when they're in the field, they know exactly where they are, and hopefully that they're still on public land versus the neighbor's private land, and hopefully avoid conflicts that way. So we've got about 10,000 users in the state that have taken advantage of that system and downloaded that data onto their handheld GPS unit. We also developed an app for smartphones, and that, again, contains all that public hunting area information. This year, for the first time, we have snowmobile trails mapped out there, and as our trail groomers are doing their job grooming the trails, they're documenting the trail condition as they go, and so the folks that have that are going out to the hills, the snowmobile, they have up to the minute, really, literally up to the minute detail on the condition of the trails and where it's good and maybe where they want to go. So we're just trying to keep up with the times as best as we can. And to be honest, we have a couple of folks on staff that are just remarkable with their ideas and innovations and certainly their technical knowledge. So we think.
So what you're saying, Mr. Secretary, is that's not you doing this?
That's not me doing that. You're right. Very safe to say that. And finally, the last slide is just to give you a heads up, a couple bills that we hope you'll have a chance to take action on. We got to, of course, get them through the House first. But the first would be to repeal the requirement that a minor be accompanied by an adult while hunting mourning doves. I don't know the history of that, but currently in statute, if you're a minor, you can't hunt mourning doves without an adult being present. And given the emphasis on youth hunting and how things have developed over the years, we think that's probably an anachronism and probably should be repealed. So we're going to have a bill to repeal that. And another bill that the department's proposing would remove the requirement to wear fluorescent orange while you're lion hunting. It's my understanding that most lion hunters aren't using orange. And it's my understanding that most of our officers are not enforcing that requirement. And since both of those things exist, and since really at this time of the year, lion hunters are about the only hunters out in the woods, we think probably we could get away without requiring orange. So that's a bill that we'll see if it gets to you or not, but it may come to you after the House takes action. And then finally, our last bill probably won't start in the Ag and Natural Resource Committee, but it is to finance the construction of a sanitary sewer system at the Angostura Recreation Area near Hot Springs. There are about 86 sites where there are camps in various states of repair or disrepair that are located on the reservoir. None or very few, I guess maybe they found three in a study that we'd done that had adequate septic systems. So over 80 of them at least had inadequate septic systems. They've been like that for a long time. We've been working with the commission. The commission's been very encouraging to us to take action and get a system in place that will provide for adequate septic treatment, sewage treatment, to protect that water body. We've surveyed the site owners. 80 of the 86 have now provided checks as earnest money to tell us basically, we want this, we're going to pay for it, and we're in. And so we view that as a really good return and a positive reflection that those folks want to keep their sites and they want to be able to continue to use that area. And so that'll actually be the financing for repayment of a bond act if it gets approved. And with that, we'll construct a sewer system and hook all of those folks up, and have that paid off over the next 20 years. So that's, the total of what I've brought for an overview today. And, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stand by for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. At this time, I'll open up for committee questions. Senator Lucas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Vonk, a couple questions on the Mickelson Trail extension to Mount Rushmore. Will there be a separate trail for horseback riders versus bike riders? And will the access points for those trails or paths be at Hill City? And if people access Mount Rushmore from that special trail, would they have to pay a entrance or parking fee as normally is the case when you can enter with an automobile?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Lucas, the horse trail will be a parallel trail to the bike trail and the hiking trail. I don't know off the top of my head what the fee structure would be for horse users. It certainly we would require the current bike fee that Mickelson Trail users have to have right now to use that trail. So that would be become part of the biking. And the hiking, I'm not sure that we charge people to hike. So,
follow up, Senator Lucas.
The other question was access. Is it going to be at Hill City? Because 18 miles would be quite a jaunt horseback up and back. And then would Mount Rushmore charge for people up there as they charge parking currently?
Madam Chair, Senator Lucas, I don't. The trailhead will start at Hill City, yes. I'm not sure what arrangement we'll end up having with the folks at Mount Rushmore and how that's going to work. I assume that we'll manage the trail, and the folks will be required to pay the fees that we establish.
For the question, Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one comment first, Secretary, Mr. Secretary. We had a Cracker Barrel on Saturday in Keystone, and one of the comments came from one of the recreation owners, campground owners, and they were concerned about the differentiation between what the park, Custer State, charges for camping compared to what the local people pay. And I know in the past this has been a continuing issue, and I guess my only comment there is that somewhere along the way, I know from my viewpoint, at least, I need to get a little bit more information, because when I looked at this a couple years ago, it looked to me like there was a differentiation, but I thought it was acceptable. But I'm not current on that, and so I'll spend some time. Just a comment, I think, as state-owned properties, it's going to be extremely important that we are cognizant of that, and I think we are, but I need more information. My questions are this. Would you elaborate just a little bit upon two of the things that are kind of hot in the news right now, when the emails that I get? One of them is pheasant production over the next, say, 10 years, decade. And the second thing is the waterfowl license, increased out-of-state licenses. Could you comment on those two issues for me, please?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Ralphberg. Thank you for those easy questions. There's little question that given the high value of agriculture commodity crops, and more than anecdotally, as you drive across the state, we are seeing more land that was in grass being put into row crop production, and that essentially is being driven by these high commodity prices. As that happens, there's also little doubt in any of our minds that our pheasant population will suffer. So I would say in the near term, the tools that we have to maintain grass and wetlands are primarily based in federal farm policy, basically because that's where the big money is. And right now, the next farm bill was essentially punted, as you, I'm sure you well know, by the current Congress until this fall. So, So there will be ongoing dialogue. Conservation programs are still in place. They're reduced in scope and effect. But we rely pretty heavily on those programs to offer incentives for farmers and ranchers to have opportunities to make choices. And if the choices all point to economic indicators that point toward more row crop production, then that's what will happen. I don't think it's a question that we're probably going to see fewer pheasants in the near term, but I don't know the magnitude of how few or how great the conversion to row crop will be. And that'll probably be determined in the next 6-8 months during farm bill debates.
Follow-up, Senator Rampelberg, and then he had the other question for the non-resident waterfowl as well. So follow-up, Senator Rampelberg.
Yes. You know, I know, Mr. Secretary, you spent some time in Iowa. I grew up on a farm in Iowa. Had great pheasant hike. But I hear Iowa being bantied around as an example of what can happen as we plant, you know, fence line or road to road, not even fence line. Is that a fair comparison for our future, do you believe, or are there other elements involved here?
Mr. Secretary.
Senator Rampelberg, I think it's fair. I mean, I think if our landscape continues to develop to continuous row crop, as you said, fence row to fence row, then really there's no habitat left for birds to reproduce and survive the winter that they need. So to the extent that we look like Iowa, then I think we can expect similar results.
Further question from Senator Rampelberg was the non-resident waterfowl concern, and he wanted to have some clarification from you on your stance on that.
So the question is that I understand that there's a limit established in statute that limits non-resident duck licenses, the 10-day variety, to 4,000. There have been bills pretty much every year since I've been here as secretary that have proposed to change that in some way, mostly to increase that number. The department's stayed neutral on that. Certainly our sportsmen have exercised their ability to voice strong opposition to having more non-residents come and hunt. None of those bills has been successful to this point in time. It would be my position that of all the game laws that we deal with in the department through our commission, all of them, the commission has the authority over setting license types, bag limits, all of those policy kinds of issues, this being the exception. And so if I were asked to take a position, which I think that's what you're asking, I would say that it would make sense to me that decision be put back with our Game and Fish Commission.
Follow-up, Senator.
Thank you, Secretary.
Follow-up. For the questions of the committee, Senator Amdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I have a question regarding the number of parks. Are there parks that exist that are in low attendance that we could, we'll say, turn back, or are they all attendance so high that we need to keep them all? I guess that's my concern. I'm always looking at the bottom dollar, making sure that if there are areas that we have parks that they're cost effective to keep open.
Right, Madam Chair, Senator Amdahl, I'm going to assume that when you talk about parks, you're talking about kind of all the parks and recreation areas. We have 12 state parks, hopefully 13 soon, but then we have another 40-plus recreation areas. And some of those recreation areas are lesser used than others. At this point in time, I would say they all should continue to be available to the public. Do some get used less than others? Absolutely. But I, sitting here talking to you today, couldn't identify an area that I would say we ought to sell out or turn back.
follow up, Senator Amdahl?
Yeah, I guess what I'm looking at, too, you know, when you got property in for the parks, you're taking them off the tax roll for, we'll say, taxes. I'm just looking at that aspect for the taxpayer.
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Amdahl, I guess my response to that is, just so we're all clear on all the wildlife areas, which you're not talking about, we do pay taxes. On many of our park areas, we don't pay taxes, but the acreage that we're talking about is so minuscule that, in my opinion, the public benefit of having green space that's open and available to the public to recreate on far outweighs what little bit of loss there might be on a tax roll.
Further questions, Senator Amdahl? Next question is from Senator Frerichs, then Senator Otten.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Secretary, thank you for the presentation, especially sharing some of the economic numbers. That's something that those of us that try to explain the relevance of certain industries is very helpful, and obviously we know that you folks rely on a nice balance with agriculture to make things work, and we know we're much bigger than what you guys have for an economic impact, but it still is obviously extremely important for our state because we are an outdoors type of state here in South Dakota. On the pheasant question, it's something that I continue to think about from time to time, and I think in your answer you talk about some federal policy, but what can we do to continue to foster the relationship of obviously a serious problem of dwindling pheasant numbers? We're not changing, you know, and going back to establishing very much more grassland out there. If it's worked up, it's obviously probably going to be farmed to some extent. Obviously, farming practices have advanced very much over the years to where we can utilize the precision technology to apply not only the seed, but obviously any fertilizer, and have minimum tillage, and obviously conservation tillage is the name of the game. But what can we do? Because we can't wait on any type of federal policy. And again, that's only going to change or maybe prevent more land to being cropped to some extent. But I guess I would ask for any ideas on how we can work to benefit that population. I think from my standpoint, though, I think back to 2 years ago when we had a very wet spring. I don't care how much habitat that would have been out there. It was very difficult for those pheasants to survive. And so it still is obviously ending on Mother Nature to work with us. And it looks like we have a somewhat moderate winter right now, and so maybe we'll see some growth. But do you have anything that we can continue to share with folks? Because we're going to continue to utilize the lands we have out there, and the producers will maximize that from an economic standpoint.
Right. Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Frerichs, yeah, your comments are all spot on. What can we do? One of the things that we've tried to do as we've seen the acres enrolled in the Conservation Reserve Program decline here in the last few years in South Dakota, one of the efforts which I mentioned was that Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program along the Jim River. That's been, I would say, fairly successful. The benefit to sportsmen there is it's based on Conservation Reserve. We put money in from the state side, which comes from our game fund, that requires that land enrolled there be open to the public for hunting purposes. So the difficulty is that's targeting 100,000 acres, and we can't frankly afford to do any more than that because it becomes an issue of funding. We do not have enough money in South Dakota to counterbalance decisions that are made nationally regarding farm policy. I would be right up front with you. I think, me talking, I think publicly subsidized crop insurance that takes the risk out of folks making a decision to convert grassland, risky ground, from grassland to crop production without having to make a decision based on substantial risk of loss is probably bad policy. And that's something that in my role here, I hope to be able to speak out to. So there are policy things that are still remain to be determined for the next 5-year cycle of the Farm Bill that I'm hopeful that our leaders in Washington will consider. Because I don't begrudge anybody the right to make a choice. As a farmer, if you want to put that ground, whatever type of ground it is, into crop production, that ought to be your decision. But I don't think that we ought to be having a public policy that says you can make that risky choice without having to suffer the risk of a failure.
Follow-up.
So where we go from there, I'm not sure.
Follow-up, Senator Frerichs.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, thank you for at least giving us your perspective. And risk is obviously an important component, and that's very fair. The problem with the CREP program has worked fairly well at the time. Now you look at those areas, though, and it's dried up significantly. Had CREP been a year or so late, you would have seen less acres easily. Less acres signed up, because I know many producers that are next to CREP that they're not against any having habitat, but at the same time they look at productive land that could be utilized. But what can we do for those places that I look, even in my immediate area, we have very little CRP to any extent, but we also have terrain that moves. We have locations that are poor land that probably should be left, whether it's slopes or whether it's places that maybe trees should be reestablished. I mean, can we do any type of partnership to where these pheasants still like to winter? I mean, they hang out right next to where I feed cattle, and they know where they can get an easy enough meal to survive, and it's great. So, I mean, what can we do to further enhance those opportunities without totally making land idle in the sense that it's never managed, it's never used to any extent? It has to sit there completely, essentially dead to the earth, except for whatever grows and dies and stays there.
Madam Chair, well, there's probably no short answer to your question. One thing that I think we could do is try and construct policy that leads decision makers toward creating that balance that you talk about. Instead of tearing out tree belts, leave the tree belts, farm to the edges. But there has to be some mechanism for you as a landowner and a farmer to receive an economic benefit from making the decision not to put every acre that you own into crop production. And that's where the federal policy comes into play. We have to have a strong conservation element to national farm policy. And then once we have that basis, then I think we can have the conversation about where can game and fish and the public policy through our Department of Agriculture and working with this body, how can we work around the edges of that strong framework? Right now, that framework is what I would say is in question, and that's what we got to work hardest on in the next 6 months.
Further questions of the committee, Senator Otten, then Senator Valley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to Blood Run being so close to an urban center, are there any numbers on estimated usage of the said park?
Senator Cripps, Senator Otten, I don't know the answer to that. We would have probably some estimation of the usage that we had last summer, which, again, would just be an early indicator, which was very heavy, given that we don't have any formal. We had some roughed out trails. Doug, if I may, do you
Doug Hofer from Game or Parks? Would
remember
you
the numbers
share?
Of what we saw last summer?
Last summer we had.
Please come up here and for the internet listeners, and then make sure to sign in. Doug Hofer from Parks.
Madam Chair, last summer our
use there was very heavy compared to what we had in terms of infrastructure. Really, we had nothing in play yet. You could go out there on just about any weekend and see 15, 20 cars that were there just out hiking, you know, mowed trails. But back to your original question, you know, what do we expect to see in the future with it being located next to Sioux Falls? I can tell you that with a dozen other state parks, we range from anywhere from 50,000 visitors a year in our lowest utilized state parks to 1.8 million at Custer State Park. This is going to fall somewhere in between. I know that's a huge range, but given its proximity to Sioux Falls, I think the day will come when a 250,000 visitors there would be easily expected. But when we get there, we'll really depend on the time it takes to really develop the area and build a visitor center and some of the things that Secretary Bonk talked to you about earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Hofer. Further questions, Senator Otten? Senator Valley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you have any statistics on the number of youth that are hunting, how that has changed through the years. You know, I think when I started out as a kid, you know, took the hunt safety course, and we all did, you know, all us kids did. And obviously we got a learned how to hunt, how to respect guns, and as we get further and further away from that and more people come from urban areas that don't live next to areas to hunt, it probably changes, you know. So do you have any statistics on that? That would be the first part of the question. And second, is there anything that the department has to encourage young people to take up the sport of hunting?
Mr. Secretary.
Senator Cripps. Senator Valley, we do have statistics on how many people, kids, primarily run through the Hunt Safe program. We have statistics on programs that we run through our outdoor education centers, the new center in Rapid City, and certainly our outdoor campus in Sioux Falls. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I'd be happy to provide those numbers, give you a historic range, if you will, recent history versus earlier times in terms of the Hunt Safe, to give you an indication. We certainly, I mentioned these programs we run. We run almost constantly programs at our offices and centers to encourage participation. Probably, again, could provide you statistical numbers of how many folks run through those programs and how they're oriented. Recruitment retention for our future is probably one of the most important elements that we look at. We've got a couple of people on staff that spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out what are the barriers to people coming into the hunting and shooting sports. Shooting is another area. You mentioned specifically hunting, but I think there's a pretty strong connection between people that shoot, people that hunt. So we're currently developing new shooting ranges in two or three locations around the state. We're investing in upgrades on a major shooting range here in the Pier area right now. So the concept here is to provide easier access, more ready access to facilities and to programs that lead both young people and frankly, it's not only young people. There's a nice reservoir of folks out there. I mean, if 21% of our populace hunts, that means 80% don't. And so there's a reservoir of opportunity out there for those people who aren't currently participating. And so through the educational programs, through creating facilities that will hopefully attract people, those are the kinds of efforts that are underway. And with your indulgence, I'll provide you with some of the statistical numbers of participants afterward.
Follow-up, Senator Valley?
That would be great. If you could furnish that to the committee, that would be good. I just think, you know, if you don't a lot of the things we do in our youth, we carry forward in our adult years. And I think that's, you know, if we have 80% that aren't, they aren't going to be teaching their kids. I mean, I went hunting with my dad. So, I mean, it's that same aspect. As that number starts falling, and the people that are not participating, they're not teaching their kids to also hunt. And I think that's where we're going to see fewer and fewer. And then that's where we develop problems, because they have no connection at all to that part of the hunting world.
Right.
Thank you.
For the questions of the committee, Senator Amdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, I have a question. How do you come up with, we'll say, an evaluation of, in reference to this visitors center? It's a lot of money. How do you come up with the idea of placing it in there, and do you offset it by not doing it? I guess my question is, what process do you use to assess whether a visitor center is needed or not?
Mr. Secretary.
Senator Krebs, Senator Amdahl, our analysis entails, well, let me back up by saying, we spend a lot of time working with folks who visit our parks. Almost every park visitor is provided the opportunity to provide feedback to us. And so basically I would tell you, over the years, as the technology of folks who come to state parks has advanced in terms of the type of recreational vehicles they use, the electronic connections that people expect, you know, the internet connections, all those kinds of things. When we don't have that, they tell us. And so I would answer your question that we try and key off of what we hear from park visitors in terms of how we look toward the future and what will improve their visitation experience. And in this case, I can't tell you that we have a specific study where we went out and said, would a new visitor center in Custer State Park make your visit better? But I can tell you that based on the feedback that we get and the value that people see in Custer Park, I would compare Custer Park to any national park in the nation. And people that visit national parks have an expectation of this kind of an orientation video. You would get that, and you probably have, if you go to the Crazy Horse Memorial, they have a theater complex there, and it helps provide the history, the background, and the opportunity that's in the park. And that's what we're trying to anticipate and move forward with at Custer Park.
Follow-up, Senator Amdahl.
Yeah, you don't do a cost-benefit type thing and with the number of people or I guess I'm still kind of confused. Is it just more of a we think we need it, or do you have real numbers?
Well, we know we have real numbers of how many people visit the park, and certainly we have real numbers and feedback from those people. And so I guess I would say, based on the high level of visitation, we certainly think that it's justified to spend the extra $1.5 million of public money that would be involved.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Roden.
Well, this might be an extension of what Senator Valley was talking about. I remember going fishing with my uncles, and their theory was, especially when I got to be a legislator, that we should pass a law requiring young people to learn how to fish, because those are the kids that are never in trouble.
And that's a good comment.
There's probably some.
And what happened, Senator Roden, to you?
Well, I wasn't a very good fisherman, obviously. But to go to Senator Valley's question, you know, I'm also involved in agriculture. Agriculture has taken some steps to try and reach out to young people through their school systems and whatnot. Is there ever been any conversation as far as beyond just your department and the education programs that you're offering, reaching out to the schools and trying to get a foot in the door as far as our K-12 system and giving that message?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Rowan, that's a great comment and question. We have a highly successful archery in the schools program, which is run in over 100 school systems in South Dakota today. I'm not sure what the exact number is. So that's a school-oriented archery development equipment's provided, the opportunity for the kids to learn and to shoot. Some states have moved in the direction of providing hunter education at the school level. We haven't done that here yet, but it's certainly something that could be considered and potentially implemented in South Dakota. We certainly are a state that I think the majority of our folks appreciate shooting guns and shooting sports and hunting, and I think it has potential to be successful, but we haven't started that yet.
Follow up, Senator Roden. Further questions of the committee, and we'll wrap this up here. Senator Rampelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for the Secretary. How come you're wearing a Roadrunner pin on your vest or your jacket there?
That's only in your part of the state, Senator.
a new predator? Okay, committee, I think at this time we'll wrap it up.
Madam Chair, with permission, we have a series of handouts from both our Parks and Wildlife Divisions that we'll leave with the committee members, and after you read this volume of material we're going to leave, we'll be happy to answer questions that might be generated from that information.
Question from the chair and a further comments from Senator Valley about the youth and hunting in numbers. I do know that there are several youth programs, the goose hunting, like you said, the archery programs, maybe a clarification of what we do offer so that we can, you know, share that with our constituents. And then total number of CRP land out there. I don't know if we had touched on that at all. So just a number out there that I do get that question a lot from constituents as well, so please share that number with us.
We will.
And thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. Thank you to the GFMP staff. We appreciate all your hard work and your comments, and we're glad you're here today. At this time, committee, I have a few introductions, and then we'll move on to our agenda, which is Senate Bill 20, which will be very quick. But at first, Senator Frerichs, personal privilege.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe out in the audience and who they've been in town for at least a day or two, are the South Dakota Farmers Union real participants. It's a leadership program that they're in. So with your indulgence, Madam Chair, could we have them stand up to be recognized?
Please stand for SDFU, real program. Welcome to Ag, which is the best committee here, so we're glad you joined us today, and welcome. Further, I believe we have some of my alma mater here from Dakota State, so Madison residents and Dakota State University staff, I believe, so please stand, and we're glad you're here joining us in this committee, and welcome to the Madison folks. And you have two great lakes by you, Lake Herman and Lake Madison, so hopefully this was an informative update from Game Fish and Parks. Moving on, before we go on to our next item on the agenda, which is Senate Bill 20, each year the brand board is required by law to compile their information, whether it be brand office information as well as fiscal year information, according to Statute 40-18-18. The report is in front of you. Again, it is just a written report that is not a verbal report that is not required, but it is a written report, so please review the brand board report that has been before you. Take note of the total number of inspections done by our brand board was 1.7 million. That's up from 1.5 million. I think that gives you some perspective as far as total number I've had inspected the last fiscal year of 12. So please take the time to review that. We will have some brand board legislation coming up on Thursday, which does pertain to some of this data. So please review that before the Thursday meeting. Moving on to the next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 20. At this time, I will take proponent testimony, and actually just comments on Senate Bill 20. Senate Bill 20 is an act to revise the purpose of the Ag Mediation Program.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Courtney DeLaRosa, Department of Ag. I'm here before you today to respectfully request to defer Senate Bill 20 to the 41st legislative day. Department of Ag worked very closely with the prime sponsor of HB 1003 and interested parties to come up with a viable solution.
Thank you, Courtney DeLaRosa, attorney for South Dakota Department of Ag. So at this time, there will be no further proponent or opponent testimony due to the hoghouse of Senate Bill 20 and into the language into House Bill 1003, which we'll be seeing. So at this time, I'm going to move to committee discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rampelberg.
I move we defer House Bills 20 to the 41st day. Pardon?
Senate Bill 20. To the 41st day?
Correct. Thank you.
Motion to defer to the 21st, excuse me, motion to defer Senate Bill 20 to the 41st day by Senator Rampelberg, seconded by Senator Amdahl. Comments on that deferral motion? Further comments? No comments? Any further comments from the committee? Seeing none, this is a vote here before you. The motion is a deferral to the 41st day on Senate Bill 20. All those in favor of the deferral motion will signify by saying aye. Opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Senators Ewing.
Aye.
Frerichs.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Amdahl.
Aye.
Otten.
Aye.
Roden.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Rampelberg.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye. Senate Bill 20 has been deferred to the 41st day. Just an update for the Thursday committee. This is all for today's agenda. We'll have the Senate Bill 16 and Senate Bill 21 and Senate Bill 59 up there. The two brand board bills on Thursday, as well as the oil and gas field disposal waste program bill. So it'll be three bills for the Thursday meeting. Any further comments from the committee? At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved by Senator Roden, seconded by Senator Valley for adjournment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate Ag so adjourned.
Remember, somebody in transportation.